everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us. Every Sunday evening when I do this program, I don't have guests. Instead, I provide the entire hour for you to call in. I'll fill in with the latest on health and nutrition until you figure out what you'd like to discuss. Our number here at the Progressive Radio Network, and it's a toll-free number anywhere in the United States, so give us a call. It's 888. Let me just get my pad out here so I can see it. 874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm starting something rather unusual. I'm going to be spending 10 days with some homeless individuals. I'm working with them with an undercover camera just to see what it's like 24 hours a day to be the new homeless in America. That means people who are college graduates, who at one time worked in very interesting industries. They were from school teachers, professor, a lawyer. And today, because they did not have a social safety net, they did not have family and people that they could stay with, where they lost their savings, they ended up losing their job. And then one day they realized that they had no money left. And then they stayed with friends. And with each person, there comes time when either they leave or they're asked to leave because of the inconvenience that creates in most people. In any case, this is not your historical poor person story. This is about all the new poor people. And it's fascinating. They come from all walks of life. And so I'm doing the same thing they're doing, except I'm not eating the food they would eat because they're not into healthy food. But I am doing everything else during a day so that I'm seeing life through their eyes, as you will see it through their eyes for this new film I'm doing on Poverty, Inc., and who profits from poverty, who creates all this. Anyhow, it's an unusual way of doing things. And when I get back into New York, I will continue for another month filming to complete this. And at that time, those in the audience, one at a time, who would like to see what this is like, I will screen you. And if I feel that you're a person that can benefit from learning this, then I'll invite you along just to spend 24 hours in the life of a homeless person. You can't imagine what kind of difference their life is today than what it was, because we actually went back to some places. In one case, a man who was worth over $100 million went to a university they donated $50 million to build a big gymnasium. Now, universities also have apartments set aside for faculty, and they frequently allow the faculty to live there for free or with a minimal payment. And when he was totally wiped out financially due to the stock market, he couldn't even get an apartment in the university that he had given $50 million to. Boy, that was a wake-up call for him. So there I'm talking with him sitting on the curb in front of the library with his name on it. Not a dime. He was fortunate that he had a friend that allowed him to stay in a little guest house that he has on his property. But how many people have that luxury? Not very many. Anyhow, all this will be shown in the film. And I take a very philosophical look. We have filmed in India, Africa, South America, showing how people have adjusted to poverty, historical poverty and the new poverty. And we're going to have a lot more new poor people in America. And we are absolutely unprepared for it. So that's what I'm working on. That's how my day is spent. Also, I just had an opportunity to hear, but because my location was not able to see, the 60 Minutes piece on Leslie Stahl? I don't know who it was, talking about the four-star general, about what Iraq is like today, and then also on the Melinda Gates, the work that the Gates Foundation is doing with $60 billion. And her three top priorities, she said, and I heard her say this, was AIDS, malaria, and the children. And then in the opening scene, the commentary was about how she believes that all life is valuable and equal. I don't believe her. And I don't believe that she is stupid. I believe she's a very brilliant woman, as is her husband. Richard Gale and myself have just completed a major, original, in-depth investigative reporting article. I used to publish my articles, oh my goodness, I'm going to say maybe 600 articles, more or less, in major magazines. And many were cover stories, many of my articles for many years. You'd see on the side of buses and billboards on the repression, suppression of alternative cancer therapies. I was the first to do national articles on that and get them out. And from that, a whole field was able to open up where we now can learn about all the doctors who had therapies that were helping people that otherwise had been buried. But today I find that rather than go to Atlantic Monthly or Harper's, instead I go to the Internet. Why? I believe that the most read article in the history of Penthouse Magazine, I was told by the publisher and by the editor-in-chief, was the article I did on the suppression of chiropractic by the AMA. I helped to lead an effort, right? I was one of the key persons in an effort to publish documents that were taken, smuggled out of the AMA headquarters in a secret department they had, ran by a man named Throckmorton and Doyle Taylor, that employed about 60 people, that was gone on for 30, 40 years, that was there to destroy any alternative therapy. But the most threatening therapy was chiropractic, because there were more chiropractors than all other holistic therapists combined. There were only a handful of holistic doctors and no holistic nurses. Naturopaths weren't given any credit, even those who graduated from the respected and accredited John Bastier College. Most of the homeopaths were not medical doctors. And acupuncture was licensed and provided as a part of the curriculum of the state educational system, but it wasn't considered a threat. But chiropractic was, because chiropractors saw a lot of patients, and they had a good influence on those patients. And they had gone over from being straight chiropractors, meaning subluxations, fixing your back and your vertebrae, realigning it, to what are called mixers. And it was rather ironic because they became mixers, the chiropractors in America, starting with the very first school, the New York College of Chiropractic, when Dr. Chester Stockham and myself created a credited degree program for Long Island University, where the chiropractors could then learn nutrition and get credit for it. And that opened it up, and from there it spread. I went down to Life Chiropractic, and then over to Palmer down in Parker Chiropractic College down in Dallas, and I work with all these. And I spread the word. And I also spread the word about how chiropractic had been undermined by the American Medical Association and all the other major medical organizations. And I won't go into the articles. There's a two-part series, and I believe that there were over 2 million free reprints requested by chiropractors. The deal was that for publishing in Penthouse Magazine, the publisher agreed that anyone who would not normally purchase or read his magazine but wanted the benefit of the articles could have them for free, just as a free reprint. And that was the most that had ever been requested. And he estimates that they had about 7 million people read the article. That was a lot, and especially up to that point. And it caused a whole lot. The AMA was found guilty of suppressing alternative therapies, restraint of trade, violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. They lost, and their loss was upheld clear to the Supreme Court, and it changed all of chiropractic, because no longer could chiropractors be denied Medicaid coverage at the state level. They couldn't be denied entrance into different schools, academic programs. It was revolutionary. It was a big deal. A lot of new chiropractors don't even know this, don't even know their own history. The older ones do. But it showed me, it taught me a very important lesson, that the mainstream media never supported chiropractors, never have supported, nor will, alternative healing, but do support mainstream medicine and mainstream foundations and mainstream thoughts, no matter how much they've been discredited. So when I look at the media today, I say bypass the general media. You don't need them anymore. I'll give you an example. The article that we have written and published up on the web, it is about Bill Gates, the new leader of the eugenics movement. There is irrefutable proof that his foundation has sponsored the development of vaccines that are, along with Rockefeller University, that are able to be contraceptive and hence prevent birth. And then we have this 60 Minutes piece, and we just put this up this week, and here's the 60 Minutes. We value all life, she says. Really? Why then aren't you suggesting that you have vaccines given to upper middle class, wealthy class, all of your friends who might want to have children? Oh, you mean there's a difference? Yeah. You want African, poor African women to be vaccinated without their knowledge to sterilize them. And it's just amazing with all the resources of 60 Minutes how they miss this completely. And as far as AIDS, all she would have to do would be to look at the 2,000 of the greatest scientific minds on the planet, Nobel Prize winners, who say that AIDS is not due to this virus, that AIDS in Africa has nothing to do with heterosexual sex. It has to do with poverty. So you would think that if you're that wealthy and you have access to all the best and the brightest, that they would all just wake up one day and see it. Well, gee whiz, here's South Africa. And South Africa has the highest reported case of AIDS in the world, which means then that all Africans living there are equally susceptible. But they're not. Lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, police officers, school teachers, sanitation workers, cafeteria operators, small business people, large business people, multinational corporate people, banking employees, bank managers, bank owners, bank boards of directors, newspaper editors, medical doctors, nurses. They don't get AIDS. How clever is that virus? It knows your economic and educational status. It knows your hygienic status. It knows how much good food you have in your refrigerator. It knows if you have a toilet that flushes and netting on your window screens to prevent mosquitoes and giving you malaria. It knows that the water you're drinking out of your tap is clean. That virus knows all that. Wow. But Melinda Gates doesn't, nor any of the people around her. If nothing else, this shows you the emperor is not only naked, but is delusional and naked. And then to the first part, here's what I would have asked. They showed a woman who said she only had electricity 2 hours a day and had to get her water by going to neighbors who had a generator because she didn't. They showed a professor who said that the best thing they could do now is bring in a military dictator to run the country. Though he was against Saddam Hussein and for the Americans, he now saw the country as just completely corrupt and couldn't govern itself. They showed all these thousands of tankers that I first reported this as the first journalist on radio in the United States to report this over a month ago on my radio program, that thousands of trucks per week, gigantic tankers, were going from Kurdistan into Iran with Iraqi oil. Well, that goes against our sanctions. But that's the politics and that's the corruption. But here's what I would have asked. I would have gone to the hospitals and said, how many children do you have being born with deformities due to depleted uranium? I would have gone to the scientists and said, how much depleted uranium do you have? And has it been measured in your water, soil, or air? And you realize it can never be removed. The half-life on it's over 3 billion years. I would have also taken a look at all the people who have been made homeless. I would have taken a look at and spoken with the 100,000 armed and highly trained Sunni arising. And the Sunni arising were paid about $300 each, plus their mullahs were paid and their sheikhs were paid millions of dollars not to kill Americans and not to kill the Shia. I would have spoken with those people. What are you going to do now? What's your next option? I would have looked at all the money that has gone missing that we've sent over there, that they don't have a water purification plant. They don't have a main electrical source. They don't have hospitals, medicines. With all the money that we have spent, if we just started in the desert from scratch without any corruption, you could have rebuilt all of Baghdad as a first-class city from nothing. But we took a first-class city and we made it into rubble, which is totally corrupt. None of that was touched upon. None of it. Unfortunate, but that's the bias in media. I'm Gary Knoll. One quick thing here. This is from Jeremy Lawrence, from Health Editor, and it says, female sexual dysfunction was invented by drugs industry. Quote, pharmaceutical firms have stoked demand for their sex disorder products, a scientist has claimed. Female sexual dysfunction, which is claimed to affect two-thirds of all women, is a disorder invented by the pharmaceutical industry to build global markets for drugs to treat it. Drug companies have invested millions in the search for a female equivalent of Viagra, so far without success. But while doing so, they have stoked demand by creating a buzz around the disorder they have created. This is according to a scientist at the University of Newcastle in Australia, Dr. Moynihan. Corporate employees work with medical opinion leaders, and they ran surveys aimed at portraying the problem as widespread and create the diagnostic instruments to persuade women that their sexual difficulties derive because they had a medical problem. But any sexual difficulty that a woman experiences is far more complex, and it may encompass lack of desire, lack of arousal, lack of orgasm, lack of the ability to fantasize, lack of having the partner that would help you fulfill your fantasies and be understanding and nurturing. These are the real causes for a lot of sexual dysfunction, not a brain chemical imbalance according to the drug industry. Dr. Moynihan, who first investigated the drug industry's role in female sexual dysfunction a decade ago, says it illustrates a wider problem about the creation of new diseases and the widening of existing boundaries for treatment with designations such as pre-diabetics and pre-hypertension and pre-osteoporosis, which means you can take a completely normal person and sell them drugs. We see it now. You see it on colleges all over the United States. People taking some form of psychiatric medication because they were told it will enhance cognition, enhance learning. There's a new book out called Sex Lies and Pharmaceuticals. It was previewed in the British Medical Journal. Here's what it says, quote, drug marketing is merging with medical science in a fascinating and frightening way. Perhaps it is time to reassess the way in which the medical establishment defines common conditions and recommends how to treat them, unquote. You bet. Good for you. You will see something like that written in the British Medical Journal. You will not see that in any of the American medical journals because their advertising comes from the very companies like Pfizer that want women to believe that you are principally a sexually dysfunctional person and all you need is, well, testosterone or Viagra or one of the other drugs they're trying to sell you. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health nutrition. Now, let's spend some time going to our audience. Again, our number is 888-874-4888. I have probably 15-minute segment every day for the remainder of the month on some aspect of vaccines. We're honoring Vaccine Awareness Injury Month, and to lend our support to that, we're bringing forward some of the finest minds in the world on the dangers of vaccines, and plus some videos you have not seen before. Let's see who we have here on the phone. Let me go over and say hello to our first person. Let's say hello to James, New York City. Hi, James.
Yeah, Gary. I want to ask you a question about if you didn't have an opportunity to get into the gold and silver at a lower rate, do you think it's still a good investment? And if you have a 401k plan, do you think it's almost time to just pay the penalty and just get the money out of there?
It depends. Let's break this down. First, I believe that silver at around $20 is completely acceptable, because silver actually is more precious than gold because there's less of it. There's a finite amount of silver, and the Chinese are cornering the world market on precious metals. Right now, they control approximately 70% of all precious minerals. Now, you have to understand what's wrong in China to appreciate what you should be doing in America. Now, why in the world should we be paying attention to what goes on in China? Because they're the persons that give us the most amount of money, and they have become the so-called superpower, and they're going to be the number one economic and energy power in the world in the next 3 years. So we're told. Here's the problem. When you have a country of 1.3 approximately billion people, and you have the fastest growing upper middle class in the world, and you are building mega cities, cities that the average American are unaware exist. Are you aware that 16 of the 20 largest cities in the world are in China? We used to be able to think, oh, there was Rome and London and Mexico City and Brasilia and New York City and L.A. Yeah, not today. Today you have cities that dwarf many of those, and they're in China. And that's because as the Chinese population has lived for a long period of time with a grossly depressed currency value, meaning their currency has been kept low, and as a result, people are able to buy Chinese goods at dirt cheap prices. So they literally are the largest exporter of goods in the world. And their number one market is the European Union. Right behind that's the United States. But also now they're developing all over Asia. You have to say, can it be sustained? And the answer is, no, it cannot. And it can't be sustained because they're living a dualistic existence. Stephen Hill of Truthdig made a comment on this. He said that the Chinese must have the best public relations in the world. How else could a country with a lower per capita income than Iran, Mexico, and Kazakhstan, one of the worst environmental records of any major nation, endemic corruption, jails stuffed with dissenters, and a dictatorship besides, be held by so many as the next global superpower? And he's right. Now, certainly China is big. Biggest population, just barely edging out India. But about the same amount of poor people. That's one-fifth of the global population. And China has long been the place for the world's biggest anything. The Great Wall, the 2008 Olympics, Tiananmen Square, the South China Mall, and Dongguan, the dam, largest dam in the world, consumption of cement, production of automobiles, most recently. And China even had the world's biggest traffic jam. I think you might have read about this, an incredible 60 miles long, which lasted a month, and during which drivers were stuck in their cars for days on end. Now, according to Hill, the world has never seen anything like mega nations the size of China, or India for that matter, and no one even knows a population of this magnitude ultimately are sustainable. I believe they are not. China's voracious need to supply its population and avoid the social explosions that have plagued its history has made it one of the world's largest consumers of natural resources, especially the timber and energy. Where do they get it? Africa, Southeast Asia, and South America. When you have such a voracious appetite, you also have the ability to drive global markets, and consequently, you become the new frontier of the get-rich-quick investors. And Western businesses go panning for gold by speculating in some hot Chinese startups. Unfortunately, according to Truthdig, the hype ignores a starker reality, that China is barely holding it together. Contrarian voices like Hu Ping, the editor and chief of Beijing Spring, which, by the way, is a pro-human rights and democracy journal, try to humanize the conventional wisdom of economic statistics and facts and obscure reality. With China portrayed in the news every day as an economic and political powerhouse, the rest of the world, at least those parts that treasure freedom and peace, should pay attention to the real China. Now, here's the paradox. To understand the real China, it's necessary to see through the double lens of its paradoxical condition as both a major economic and still developing country. And China is filled with contradictions and serious challenges. And, for example, right after the Olympics, whether in Shanghai, Beijing, or rural areas, a long, long way from being a global leader in any meaningful sense, 200 million people out of a working population of 800 million are migrants, chafing at the lowly status and rotten wages. Inequality is rampant, returning from the rural areas where the vast majority of Chinese still live to cities is like a form of time travel. Moving from feudal conditions where plowing is still done by water buffalo to a land of impressively jutting skyscrapers. And all countries are corrupt. India, in my opinion, is one of the most stupid, fetish, ugly countries ever. And we give it credit it doesn't deserve. It's a racist, terribly racist country. And everything about it stinks. But it's rich. And it answers your phone calls and sells you things. Well, corruption is also endemic in China. It's in the banks, it's corrupt. The legal system is completely corrupt. The political leadership is all corrupt. And provincial and local levels, everybody's corrupt. And that causes an estimated annual economic loss of approximately 15% of its gross domestic product. Even China's much-touted economic power has been misunderstood. Recently, it was announced around the world that China had surpassed Japan to become the second-largest national economy. But compared to the United States and Europe, China is still an economic mini-me. Europe's gross domestic product is $17.5 trillion, according to the latest International Monetary Fund figures. The United States, we're at $14.8 trillion. China, $5 trillion. And beyond economic output, more than three-fifths of China's overall exports, nearly all of its high-tech exports, are made by non-Chinese foreign companies. Foreign companies take advantage of low Chinese wages to reprocess imports of semi-manufactured goods that are then shipped to Europe and the United States. China remains, in essence, a subcontractor to the West. And despite China's export success, there are few great Chinese brands. Well, let me ask you. James, New York City, yeah. Name me three famous Chinese brands.
Brands themselves?
Yeah.
Don't know.
Well, okay. What do you want to bet that if you walk down on Wall Street, they couldn't name you three also? Go to the campus of Columbia University where I film frequently because I want to see how stupid people are, and I'm never disappointed. So if a country is doing all this great work, wouldn't you imagine they would have some original brands? But that's not the case. China needs to build them, yes. But you're not going to build famous brands that can compete in the world when you have a one-party authoritarian state where the party second-guesses business strategy for ideological and political ends. It's impossible. And because of China's climate of corruption, which is endemic, an authoritarian secrecy which is everywhere. Even the volume of industrial output, I would say they lie constantly. I would never believe anything a Chinese told me from their government about anything. So don't believe the Chinese numbers. And China, state-run companies are buying fleets of cars. But guess what? Those are cars that they buy and store them in parking lots and warehouses. Why? It pumps up the state-mandated production figures. And as evidence of this, the experts point out that while car sales have been rising by a huge 20% per month, gasoline is rising by 3% per month. Now, maybe I missed something, but you got to have gasoline to run a car. So if you've got all these cars being sold, then you've got to have gasoline to match it. No, they're storing them. That's how they do it. They do all these crazy things there. And they're in the largest real estate bubble in the world. Their high-rise buildings, their offices, condos, houses, all are in a bubble. In fact, much of China's high growth originally came from decades-long heavy investment in infrastructure. But increasingly, it's become from construction. 50 to 60% of China's gross domestic product now comes from alarming levels of overbuilding, virtually none of which is affordable to the average Chinese. This is not affordable housing for middle class. It is high-end condos in major urban areas and high-end office buildings which no one's buying. Gee, let's think about Las Vegas. Las Vegas is going to be a ghost town. It's finished. It's dead. It's over. The only thing that'll still be there will be Wayne Newton's hairdo. It'll last for eternity. China is on a treadmill to hell because so much of the gross domestic product growth comes from construction which can't be sustained. So if China were to slow down, the construction industry, its gross domestic product, would go negative very quickly. That's simply common sense, but it's backed up by James Chanos and others who've written about this. So you've got to understand what you're dealing with. And look at that environment in China. The only thing cloudier than China's economic model is the sky over its major cities. So choked with smog that some days you can't see the high-rises a few blocks away. And during a run-up to the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, many were concerned that athletes wouldn't be able to breathe the foul air. So to clear the air, the government instituted an odd-even auto policy, meaning the cars with license plates ending in the even numbers could drive only one day, odd numbers the next day. People in Beijing said that the skies had not been so clear in decades. Just an aside, as I was out in California recently, a professor and his daughter were driving me around, and she had just returned from Beijing, where she's at the university, and she said there are days when if she put her arm straight forward, she could not see her fingers. That is how polluted Beijing is. In fact, here's a number you didn't hear about. 400,000 Chinese die every year of respiratory diseases caused by pollution. Now, about 500 million rural Chinese, equivalent to the population of the entire European Union, still do not have access to safe drinking water. Acid rain caused by sulfur dioxide emissions that belch from smokestacks and power plants is endemic, with the state-run China Daily reporting that in the Guangdong province, China's most prosperous region and its most industrialized, 53% of total rainfall was acid rain. Food scares such as industrial toxins mixed in milk powder and pet food and cough syrups have been frequent. And these consumer dangers are additional manifestations of an amoral, corrupt, robber baron business practices that are the rule, not the exception. In fact, in 2008, earthquakes in western Shishun province, which resulted in the collapse of more than 7,000 schoolrooms and thousands of deaths among schoolchildren, disproportionately impacted the poor who live in an area where corruption had resulted in shoddy construction practices. The suicide rate among the elderly in rural areas of China is 500% higher than anywhere else in the world. And 90% of all the elderly have no retirement pensions. even as there's a shortage of nursing homes. So what they do in China, when they get old and they're poor, they simply, well, they end their lives in a barren landscape or in a forest to avoid being a burden to their children. They drink poison or cut their throats. China has more protests than any other country in the world. 70,000 different protest marches last year. And a lot of them turn into riots, and violent riots. 300,000 labor disputes in just 1 year. And so we look at China as China, Inc., an ancient land where the entire country is run like a giant corporation. And it's kind of like a capitalist communism, an oddball combination. And so it's had all this growth, but understand China's per capita gross domestic product is still $3,600. In the United States, it's $46,000. So don't be too, don't be too eager to look at China as the deciding factor of why we should be buying gold or silver. I would say that you buy silver in a modest amount and gold in a modest amount because as you and the rest of the public are beginning to become fearful of the sustainability of the dollar, and rightly so, the piranhas on television are making astronomical markups, generally around 30%, by getting people to buy gold when if you want to buy gold, you should buy gold and pay only about 8 to 10% as a commission, no more, not a penny more. And if you can get it for less, do so. Don't buy antique. It doesn't mean anything. And buy the smallest denomination you can, generally 1 ounce. And it is not a matter of bartering or trading. It is a backup emergency if all else fails. Liquefy your assets so that you are as liquid as possible, because when the hyperdeflation occurs on the value of what we own, meaning 40 to 50% loss in the value of cars, homes, recreational vehicles, those people who made the mistake of getting everything on mortgages and not getting out of the market will simply lose it. And get rid of your credit cards. Keep only one credit card for emergencies and don't use it unless it's an emergency. And that's how I would go about managing my finances. That's how I manage my finances. Okay, James?
Yeah, what about the 401ks?
I've already got out of my 401k. I paid the penalty and got out.
Okay, all right,
thanks
very much.
As a result, I didn't lose anything.
Right.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Let's say hello to David from Oregon. Hi, David.
Yes. Question is on stem cells. What will amplify stem cells in the body through nutrition, herbs, supplements, so on, if anything that you know of?
Well, right now, there is work being done by Dr. Lipton, Bruce Lipton, and others in the field of molecular biology that are looking at the impact of the energy that feeds the gene and hence the cells. And I'm going to do a commentary on it this week. In fact, I was writing the commentary today. I don't have it completely finished, but I will later tonight. And I'll just give you a rough review. You'll hear it articulated in about a 15-minute commentary one day this week at my noon show. We now know that it's not the cell per se that dictates the outcome of all events, which we've been led to believe. But rather, it is the blood and water that's in there that conditions itself based upon energy transference from the people around you, your own experiences, and how you choose to interpret those experiences. So let's say that you have a father or mother, one or the other, that was not giving you the unconditional support or acknowledgement you needed as a child. there was a missing piece. So you develop some doubts, doubts about your completeness, doubts about who you are as a person, your value as a person. And maybe they went further and put you down so that you actually felt that you were stupid or unworthy. That is first interpreted by the brain, but immediately the brain then creates an energy, and the energy vibrates at a certain level that all the blood and all the water in the body that go into the cell, that becomes the life of the cell, 74% of your body's water, that carries a message. And the message then resonates and becomes the message of the cell. And that's why some people don't realize that if you shed a tear, and if your tear is one of joy, there's different chemicals in the tear of joy than if you shared a tear out of anger or out of fear or depression. Then you have higher levels of cortisol. You have different chemicals. The average person would have thought a tear is a tear. It is not. Yet again, it's a different energy. So by understanding that we have more control than what we had ever previously thought, by merging the new science of quantum physics, spirituality, and molecular biology, we are seeing that we can actually control the cells and have enormous amount of control over it. And now we are, once we have first established that this is possible, then the idea is, well, what can we do? How do I gain access to this so I can use this? And yet that's what many of us have been doing for a long period of time before we actually had the science to verify it. For example, when I did a study back in first in 1975 and then again in 1977 at the Institute of Applied Biology, which was a very conventional research institute that had been there over 50 years. It's been closed for about 10 years now. But I was a junior scientist at that time, and I was the oddball. And I wasn't around those people because they were doing chemotherapy research. I was upstairs. I was doing my nutrition research. But I also had the freedom to do some psi research, and I did a lot of it. I remember once someone brought me a book on pyramid power by a fellow who I was just talking with, a friend of Flanagan's. And he's still around, and from what I understand, still writing.
Yeah.
So I took Flanagan's book on pyramid power, and he had a series of statements there about, if, you know, rats don't putrefy when they die in the pyramid, they mummify. So I built all the pyramids to exact specifications, and all razor blades don't go dull. I did 16 separate pyramid experiments. Not one showed me that the statements in the book I could duplicate. But I kept neutral and let the results be what they were. But it was also where I did the first research ever done on measuring the vital life force and energy of food, which is what allowed me to create the dietary recommendations that I do today, and even my inventions today. Green stuff, greens and grains, red stuff, berry blast, are all based upon concentrating energy. In any case, it's also where I did the first experiment to prove that people can exchange energy from a healthy person to a sick animal. And we did this. Dr. Dolores Krieger was in there, head of nursing at NYU, and from that study came therapeutic touch. I have the photograph of that up on my website. In the laboratory with her, there you see Dr. Krieger, you see Rabbi Abraham Wiseman, you see Dr. Thomas Kruth, you see all these people in there and doing the study. In any case, I could prove that I could prove a phenomena existed. I could not prove how or why. I could prove what. Now, that's important. That's extremely important to understand the difference between what versus why and how. So if you said to me, Gary, can you grow hair if you have male pattern baldness? I could say yes, because I've done it in studies and presented the results at major scientific symposium before thousands of scientists, who in turn have used my protocols and come up with interesting results and have been able to duplicate it. But if they said, How, I can only give them a hypothesis. If they said why, again, a hypothesis. But what? No, that's fact. Fact. Have I been able to create protocols to reverse disease in people? Yes. How I did it is speculative. In other words, but what I did is not. It's like I took 14 people with advanced AIDS. The average length of time in treatment was 14 months. The results, every single one reversed all their AIDS-defining conditions, reversed their blood chemistry, and went from HIV positive to HIV negative, and all were medically verified because they were all done in a medical center under medical supervision, and their records and results were presented at the press conference in New York City. And by the way, there was a whole panel of scientists who were sitting there, and one of the people who was an observer of all this was, at that time, Senator David Patterson, now Governor Patterson. No media showed up. None. Not one media showed up. Yet 100 individuals showed up with their medical records who had been in the Tri-State Healing Center AIDS therapeutic model. By the way, not one paid a nickel for their therapy. They were all treated for free. Rather interesting when one of these quackbusters, oh, Gary Knowles is an AIDS denier. No, Gary Knowles probably helped more people with AIDS than any human being on the planet. I've helped over 2,200 people with AIDS save their lives. The difference is I am proud to be a person that challenges the quackery, the hypocrisy, the lies, and the fraud of what we call the war on AIDS, because it's all a fraud. But in any case, it's the same principle works on stem cells, the same identical principle. So if I'm able to change the DNA manifestation in a group of men and women who have male pattern baldness to where they have a statistically significant improvement in reversing baldness, even yesterday in our health support group in New York City, a man got up who had been completely bald and today has all this black hair in the middle of his head, and he's over 50 years old. And again, this is what you're seeing. Now, if you say exactly how it's done, I could give you a hypothesis. I cannot absolutely prove my hypothesis correct. All I can do is show you the what was the outcome. The outcome is what we should be focusing on. In our society today, we should be looking at what, not why. And if you change from what to, if you change from why to what, then you're on the road to healing. For example, if you... if you think that people are not easily manipulated and sold things, just understand this. We like things because we're told to like things, not because they are likable from our own discerning minds and experiences. That's unfortunately how people vote in presidents. That's how we continue to vote in legislators. That's how come we still read biased magazines or listen to biased radio shows or watch biased television, because we're told to. And then they tell people what to believe. So look carefully at the what. And remember, we like something because we're told to like it. I could show you restaurants that have crappy food, terrible service, are overpriced, but everyone's told, well, that's a hot restaurant, so people go to it. And great restaurants with great food and great taste and great prices are empty. Movies that we're told are brilliant movies, and you see it and think, what were they thinking? Well, that's the problem. They're not thinking. They're told what to like. Mind you, this whole thing, what are their names? The Carl Sagan's, or I don't watch television, so I don't know the name. They're famous because they got big asses. That's it. They have no talent. They don't do anything. They're famous for their asses. So we're told, oh, watch these people. Watch how they talk with each other in their house. Let's watch how they go shopping. Let's watch. Why? Because we're told we're supposed to like it. We're told we're supposed to watch sitcoms because they're funny. That's how Americans live. That's why we do not have a democracy that's functioning. That's why we don't have freedoms. That's why we're not healthy. And that's why we're not happy. Kardashians, I don't know their name. Something, I think you'll know who I'm talking about. I think it's Kardashians. Anyhow, they're just a bunch of fat women, or fat-ass women, and they've made their fat asses the entire cause of their existence. And now that they've got everyone accepting that, then everything else comes after that. They show up and they're supposed to be oohed and awed because they're famous. If you say, why are you famous? Because I got a fat ass. Why should that make you better than anyone else? Because you were told that whoever has the fat ass should be made famous. And you bought into it. Whoa. Okay, let's say hello now to Mark from Washington, D.C. Hi, Mark.
Gary, how are you?
Doing great, thank you.
Thanks. I was listening to your show, I believe it was either Thursday or Friday, and you talked about your body fat percentage, and you've often talked about your height and weight ratio. And I wanted to get some feedback on two points related to that. Number one, does that take into account your athletic ability or the amount of sports you've played over a period
yes,
of time?
Yes, it does. If I was not as athletic as I am for as long as I've been athletic, I would probably be around 9% body fat.
Okay. Okay. And then the next point comes down to...
Remember, because I said that the average man should be around 10% to 12% body fat.
And you said that yours was 3%, I think.
That's at the high end.
Okay.
When I'm training and running marathons or when I'm training and running shorter races, it's about 1.8 to 2.7.
So several months ago, I had called in, and you pointed me in the right direction to become a vegan athlete. I've always been an athlete, and I became vegan about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. But I had never combined the two things together, and now I'm on that path. So my question is that I have lost considerable weight at the beginning, even as an athlete, but moving to a plant-based diet. But there are still some problem areas. And so that's preventing me from reaching that body fat percentage. And I'm about 6 feet.
What percentage body fat are you?
12.
Okay. That body fat would come down if you did your running. But if you do your running, you're going to have a loss of the muscle mass, the high-definition muscle mass. You can't have both.
And then I tore a ligament very badly a while ago, so I've just been doing biking as I'm doing physical therapy to get...
Okay, well, the biking is not going to hit all the muscle groups. Remember, you lower your fat when you're aerobic. The fat on your belly does not belong to the belly muscles. The fat on your hips doesn't belong to the hip muscles. So you have to... The body fat belongs to the entire metabolism. So it's only when you raise your metabolic rate by exercising that you're going to be using those extra calories and the glycerol and the fatty acids for energy. And then if you take in the L-carnitine and D-ribose and glutamine, you're going to be providing the sustainable energy. But as long as you're between 7 and 10% body fat, you're fine. That would be at the high end of high quality in the United States for an athlete. So you have nothing at all to be concerned about. All right. Do not use my body fat as an example.
I understand.
All right.
I understand. So the point is I can continue to do the biking, but to get into, you know, once my knee is in a condition that it's stable, to start doing running and add that into the weightlifting, and I can still do biking as well.
Absolutely.
Perfect.
All the best
to you,
Mark. And let's say hello to Victoria from San Francisco. Hi, Victoria.
Oh, hi. I'm calling to get the what for trigeminal neurology.
All right. How long have you had it?
I just was diagnosed, so I'm doing my research to see I don't want to take pills. I want to. They say they don't know where it comes from, and it's just something that it's really disturbing and frightening for me because I was getting attacks and I couldn't drive and that kind of thing.
All right. How are your symptoms manifesting now?
In the face, they start like where the sinus is at, and then go into the eye.
Uh huh. Okay. Have you used pulsated magnet therapy?
No, I haven't done anything except taking the pills that the doctors gave me, and I don't want to take them.
All right. Have you tried using magnesium citrate at 1,000 milligrams?
No. Is that what I should be?
These are first of all, educate yourself on the alternative approaches that are natural and non-toxic, not to exclude the traditional approach, but I'm just saying that always start with that which is least toxic to the body. And then build it gradually.
Okay.
All right. And what you want is you want to be able to relax the entire musculature. You want to keep the body from having any form of spasms and hence pain. And cayenne, curcumin, cat's claw, red clover, adaptogenic herbs such as ginseng, feverfew, these are the ones that I would focus upon and emphasize.
Okay.
Also, acupuncture.
And in the meantime, I still have to keep taking the pills.
You can take the pills until you see that what else you're doing is making a difference, and then you can reduce the pills accordingly in conjunction with the improvements. It's no different than a high blood pressure or insulin. As you see that your blood sugar is being corrected, you can reduce the insulin until hopefully you can go off the insulin. That's the whole point. But if you're not getting your blood sugar down, then you can continue to use the insulin. So I tell people always monitor it, especially if they're working with a physician, so that the physician can see, okay, as one is benefiting the person, then the other can come down and hopefully come down and be eliminated. Has it been completely eliminated? Yes, it has.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I've seen people who've completely eliminated it.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I'll check on the things that you just said. Thanks.
Okay. All the best to you.
Okay.
I'm looking at the clock, and we're out of time. Michael Rupert is going to be up next with the Lifeboat Hour. And tomorrow, I'll be on at our noon time. And we're going to have a month dedicated to giving you the latest on vaccine information. And as always, the information comes from peer-reviewed literature, from qualified science. And it's confusing to people because, on the one hand, the American media is so completely compromised by the major official agencies. It's just like everybody's wearing pink this month because of breast cancer. Well, of course we're concerned about breast cancer. But ask yourself, how many campaigns of walk for the cure? And then, but there's no cures. There's just more dead people. AIDS, breast cancer. And they don't want to know about the alternative. Then ask yourself, who's behind this whole campaign? More often than not, it's a chemotherapy company. Or it's a major foundation that makes lots of money but doesn't have cures. And then they exclude people who have ideas and have actual results that could benefit them, no matter what the person's background or credentials. It could be a Harvard-trained physician and board-certified. But the moment you step out of line and you're no longer singing the same tune, you're out the door. And that's unfortunate because we have so many brilliant minds in this country who are today helping people get well using different approaches. And not once does the mainstream media give them any credibility because mainstream medicine is threatened by them. But mainstream science supports it. So use mainstream science, jump over medicine, jump over the media, and connect with the people. I'll look forward to sharing more with you tomorrow at noon and at 3 o'clock. Two shows tomorrow. Have a nice evening. Stay tuned right now. Michael Rupert and the Lifeboat Hour.